America will always defend democracy in its hour of need. We tell our allies, we will stand with you. We tell our adversaries, don't mess with us. We tell the world, we will do everything to defend.
U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer struck a hopeful note as Congress finally approved a multi-billion dollar package of support to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan earlier this week. From America's allies, and Ukraine in particular, a collective sigh of relief. Equally so, I think, in the surroundings I'm in tonight to bring you a very special edition of the Power Play podcast from the British Embassy here in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Power Play from Politico, where we talk to some of the world's most influential people on either side of the Atlantic. I'm Anne McElvoy, your host, and joining me this week from 3100 Massachusetts Avenue is Dame Karen Pierce, the UK's ambassador to the United States. We are, as you can tell if you're here, but maybe not if you're listening, in front of a larger audience outside Edwin Lutyens' imposing building, a hub of the ties between the two nations throughout the political hurly-burly of many decades. Someone who's seen that up close as a reporter, editor, and founder is John Harris, Politico's global editor-in-chief, veteran observer of events on both sides of the pond. John Harris. John is going to be joining me a little later on the podcast to reflect on Dame Karen's conversation, and also, seeing as Politico likes the inside track, to tell us what to watch out for as we head into one of the biggest weekends in Washington's social calendar, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and all that goes on around it. But first, Dame Karen Pierce, welcome to Power Play.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be here. Very nice to see everybody.
So we're speaking just a couple of days after Congress finally approved a $95 billion package of aid to Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, $61 billion of that going to Ukraine. Many months of haggling and a lot of work that went into that. We saw Lord Cameron, the UK Foreign Secretary, visit a couple of weeks ago urging Congress to pass that bill. How involved were you in making that case? And basically let us in on your diplomatic wiles.
Well, diplomats don't have wiles, obviously. Diplomats are straight and honest at all times, whatever historical quotes from Churchill and others might have implied otherwise. But David Cameron, the British Foreign Secretary, as you say, Anne, was here at an important moment. He did see a lot of Democrats, a lot of Republicans, and we were delighted to see the package passed. I think for Ukraine, it's an important boost on the ground. I think the Pentagon did a great job of getting the equipment out of the door and on its way to Ukraine almost as soon as the bill was signed. And if we played a part in that, then we're very pleased. But I think it's a collective expression of how important it is to support Ukraine, how important it is for all our security that Ukraine is able to push Russia back. And if we don't stop Putin in Ukraine, the rest of Europe will not be safe.
As part of this rather significant charm offensive, you dined with Lord Cameron and Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. Now, to be a fly on the wall at that one, now that would be actually the Politico reporter's dream. So what were your memories of it? How will you recall it? You can give us a bit of a sneak preview of your memoirs.
Unfortunately, this is never going to appear in the memoirs. It was a private conversation. It was
a
warm and thoughtful conversation, but we've decided that we won't talk about it. It was, above all, a private conversation.
There's nothing more you can say about it.
I'm afraid not.
But was there really then a meeting of minds? Because I think what people are curious about, I mean, we saw that struggle to get that bill through Congress, and particularly on how to deal with Russia and Ukraine. In some ways, this did look, to put it in punchy terms, like a bit of a win for UK diplomacy. It was certainly played a role along with others. We saw President Trump then tweeting about wanting a strong and stable Ukraine. But it must be said that although it passed in the House, this bill with bipartisan support, more Republicans voted against it than for it. Is that concerning to you?
I think what the vote did show was that the majority of Congress overwhelmingly supports the funding for Ukraine and supports helping Ukraine militarily. And whether numbers were up or down in a small handful of cases, I think the central message, which is going to give Ukraine a huge psychological boost, is that America is behind her and Congress is behind her. And our will to support Ukraine is undimmed. And that's a really important message for Putin to hear, because part of the Putin playbook is that he likes dividing Europe from America and he likes trying to sow dissent among us. So I did want to salute the congressional leadership in the House and in the Senate on both sides. As you say, the Foreign Secretary had some very good conversations with them. This is the right answer, and it's a collective expression of our determination to push back on President Putin's ambitions.
This is hardly a valid victory, because you're going to be around, I think, till the end of this year. Is that right? This is the time that you're scheduled to leave your post?
I think the next ambassador will arrive in early 2025, and I'll stay till then. And I'll have to be dragged out of here by my fingernails, I'm afraid.
Well, I mean, that might happen, actually, because there has been a bit of a kerfuffle, hasn't there, about the appointment of your successor this week. Reports Rishi Sunak was about to announce that, and then there seemed to be a bit of a step back from that. The news was expected in diplomatic circles, and it wasn't denied by the PM. That's all now gone quiet, and stories that Labour thought that this was not welcome were displeased at basically, you know, being scooped on that appointment. And what do you make of it? Because it seems unusually dramatic for a handover.
The Foreign Office is very boring about two things, and two things only, by the way. One is that we don't reveal diplomatic conversations. And the second is we don't comment on future appointments. So I'm afraid that's all I have to say.
It does look a bit eventful.
I've said what I've said.
Well, what we really got was that you didn't want to leave at all, so maybe you could be extended in the post. Just a thought. You know, I'm just trying to help. Anyway, let's look back a bit at what you've experienced since you have been in post ambassador. And you arrived March 2020, just a few months after Boris Johnson was elected to get Brexit done. Then we had the pandemic. Then we had, of course, Donald Trump versus the Biden round one, and the rather disturbing drama of the 6th of January 2021. Three prime ministers in 3 months. And all of this kind of happens within about, I think, the first couple of years you're here. How much sleep did you get?
I thought for one horrible moment you were going to draw a causal link there. But I'm very glad you didn't go down that avenue. There was a little bit of a wry smile on the faces of some American politicians when we had that quick turnover of prime ministers, because it's not what you think of when you think of British politics. On the contrary, you think of something solid that doesn't change very much for years. But we're through all that. The economy is doing well. The government is doing well. They're determined to keep supporting Ukraine, to keep working with America and other allies on Israel, Gaza, and all the other problems that we face, and things are going well.
I just do want to pause on that moment, the events of the 6th of January and the turmoil that ensued, and just ask about your personal response to that. You're very well plugged in here. You spend a lot of time around the capital, and you were close then to what happened, and therefore to the violence that erupted there. What did you... It's an extraordinary thing to go through, and I know you've had a very, very diplomatic career. You've also... You've been a representative in war zones, in the Balkans, you know, many more unstable countries. But this was a moment when the world held its breath about America. And how did that feel to you?
What I think I said at the time, and the Prime Minister certainly said at the time, that all our lives we had grown up with America as a beacon of democracy. And against that background, I think 6th of January was a shock to very many people. But we also said at the time, and we still firmly believe, American democracy will sort this out. The American people will sort this out. So we didn't have a more fundamental worry, if that's the implication of your question.
And you've seen both Presidents Trump and Biden at close hand. When I interviewed a predecessor of yours, Kim Darroch, in the last edition, in fact, of this podcast, he, people will remember, got into a bit of hot water by a cable that he wrote warning of the risks, as he saw it, of Donald Trump to the international system and to the relationship with Great Britain. Do you feel reassured that a Trump 2.0, were that to happen in the elections later this year, would be, should we say, copable, withable in a different way to that mood that Lord Darroch was referring to?
Well, in fact, I was in America, but I was at the UN when Kim was sending his analysis back. And obviously, diplomatic analysis is not meant to be leaked. And that was a terrible thing that happened. But our job as a British embassy, my job as ambassador, the job of all my colleagues here tonight who are ambassadors, is to get on with the administration that the American people choose to elect them. And that's what we're determined to do. America is our indispensable ally. We hope that we are America's indispensable ally. We have a very solid bedrock of the foundation of this deep, profound and special, if you like, special relationship. And our job is to find ever more ways of strengthening that and taking it into new areas. So we've done a lot of work on things like artificial intelligence, trying to get our cooperation on AI as deep and as thorough as it is on security and defence.
But are you suggesting a little bit that whether it's the UK or perhaps other European allies need to kind of roll with the blows a bit about who ends up in the White House, and that now there seems, coming back to DC for me after being there when Donald Trump was president, as we go into this election year, and who knows who'll be president at the end of it, that there's a bit more of a sense of we better just be ready for anything. Do you think the diplomatic mindset has had to change as a result of what has happened in US politics, both in your time and the time that preceded?
I personally don't feel that, and I personally don't think that. I think if you look at American politics, even post-World War II, there have been some quite turbulent moments. And that is in the nature, I think, of America and its democracy and its very vibrant politics. And I know people worry about the overly partisan nature of American politics, and we should all worry when things are overly partisan and you can't have a rational debate and people are not tolerant of other people's point of view. But I think for us in the UK and many of the allies here tonight, the key thing we have grown up with that has kept the world safe and prosperous on the whole since 1945 has been American leadership and their generosity and altruism. And our job in the embassy is to help enable that, to encourage it, to problem solve, and above all, to burden share. And the announcement of another $500 million for Ukraine that the Prime Minister made recently, I think is a great example of our doing exactly that.
Just a last thought before, as you can hear, the convivial levels are rising, and you're actually rather well known in Washington for running a very convivial embassy. Is this part of the secret sauce? We've heard wild rumours of nights of whiskey and cigars and power broking that go on around here. You do like a good cocktail party too. Is that part of, do you need training for that? Or does it come naturally?
There was a time when I just joined the Foreign Office where I was scared stiff of parties. But as you can see, I got over that. And if anyone thinks this is only cocktails, allow me to say there's some very fine whiskey on the back patio.
I think we're going to have some very, very envious listeners to this podcast.
Well, I think this is what embassies do best. They bring people together. They provide a forum. We're very lucky to partner with Politico in providing this interesting and lively forum for everyone to enjoy tonight. We can bring people together from not only different walks of life, but different politics. And therefore, if we provide the setting, we hope you will come in good spirit.
Last question. Everyone gets, as part of the Power Play experience, who would you like to hear on the podcast? Who would get you putting it on your playlist, which is where we'd love it to be?
Oh, that's a fascinating question. I have to say, I'm hopeless at questions like this on the spot. So I'd have to actually think about that. I enjoy the podcast. I enjoy listening. I mean, given that President Putin has a playbook, maybe you could interview President Putin and give him a harder time than some other American interviewers have given him.
That's going to be quite a job for the bookers. Producers, did you get that? President Putin on the line. Thank you very much indeed, Dame Karen Pierce, for joining us on Power Play.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Anne.
Coming up, I'll be joined by Politico's global editor-in-chief, John Harris, to reflect on my conversation there with the ambassador and give us his own flavour of how Washington comes out to play on one of the biggest weekends of the year. Welcome back to this special edition of Power Play, coming to you from the British Embassy in Washington. Sitting beside me is a doyen of this town, no other than Politico's global editor-in-chief, John Harris. Hello, John, and welcome back to Power Play.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. And a doyen, that's a good thing or a bad thing, you can tell me?
It's a good thing.
Okay.
It's a good thing in the English world, and clearly hasn't crossed the Atlantic, unlike Politico, she said, on brand.
Very much so.
Now, listen, what did you make of my conversation with the ambassador, with Karen Pierce? Do you think she lowered her guard a little bit, knowing that she's leaving the stage? Well, I noticed you were listening quite intently in the audience.
Well, I thought it was a fantastic conversation. Both of you were in high spirits. But underneath that, obviously the gravity of this situation was obvious. And however eloquent she was in answering what she wanted and avoiding what she didn't want, I thought the message was unmistakable, one of real concern about the reliability of the United States as an ally and as the leader of the West, great uncertainty about the future of Ukraine, which in her words is really an issue about the future of the security of the West.
That's interesting. She came back to Ukraine many times. It must be said she also did, in fairness to the ambassador, she did mention Gaza and the need for serious attention to Israel-Gaza in a previous conversation before we started recording here. So it wasn't like she missed it out. But my sense was she returned to it almost insistently, as if she did have some worries that despite that big package that finally got across the line in Congress, that there was a shakiness about America on what's going on in Ukraine. Was that the way you read it, Sue?
Well, if you believe what she believes and you see the moral stakes of this moment as she sees them, how could you not be worried? It would be non-rational to not be worried. As your question, Anna, shrewdly pointed out, the aid package has passed Congress narrowly, but a majority of Republicans voted no. They don't agree with her that this is one of the central moral questions facing the West right now. And of course, people can read the polls. It's obviously a 50-50 possibility that we would have former President Trump back in office for a second term, leading that Republican Party that's skeptical of the Western Security Alliance, has run out of patience with helping Ukraine. So that's profound. Yes, she would be crazy if she wasn't worried, don't you think?
I think so. I thought it was interesting, the Mar-a-Lago question. Everyone wants to know what happens when you go to Trump world. She was very proper then, almost a bit stern with me. Sometimes that happens with interviewees. I think when she said, we have agreed that we will not kind of spill the beans on that.
I was really struck by that.
What did you make of that?
Well, because,
I think she was obviously being polite, but I felt that it was almost a kind of guardedness about how to handle that relationship.
Well, you saw her in that good conversation. She could play with any of your questions, even the one she didn't really want to answer exactly the way you asked it. She could play along. On that one, she didn't want to play along. It would have been easy for her to make a quip or two or to talk about the food, talk about the setting. She wanted to talk about none of it. That's because I assume she thinks it's not a joking matter, the possibility that President Trump would return to power and stand for policies that are the exact opposite of what she's looking for from the United States.
She said at one point, I think later in the interview, that she thought, in a sense, the UK and by extension other European partners and allies, that they had to be prepared for whatever might come. So I wondered, having covered this in detail, do you sense a big difference to the way that when Donald Trump arrived, first there was a bit of kind of shock and awe, and not much of it, you know, in the democratic world was it, or in a good sense. Do you think there's a difference now that the transatlantic relationship is, if you like, a bit hardened to the idea of a Trump return?
You know, I think from the perspective of allies, they have to do something that we as reporters do, and really the whole country's had to do, which is try to decide which part of President Trump's persona to take seriously. We've gotten accustomed to flamboyant rhetoric. We've gotten accustomed to things that from in any other context, from any other American leader, for instance, that Putin should feel free to endanger the security of countries that don't pay the full amount of NATO dues. That's outlandish. At some point, though, outlandish rhetoric, you learn to say, well, I don't need to take that literally seriously. And I think that's the real message of the trip down to Mar-a-Lago. Look, if you return to power, we can deal, right? You don't mean everything you say. There's a middle ground here. And I think that's what Western allies would be hoping for with a second Trump term. You know, your question, I think, implicit in that is like, well, what if he really means it? What if this does mean the erosion of the or breakup of the NATO alliance? What if he does say to Putin, you know what, you can have this, and we're not going to halt you. We want to settle this war. My coalition is tired of it, and so you've got, if not a green light, certainly a yellow light to wrap this up.
Give us your broad sweep, John, if you could, of the transatlantic highs and lows in the relationship that you've witnessed. I mean, you've seen a lot of it up close. You're smiling at me now in a knowing way, because I always ask you for anecdotes. And I think sometimes people, you know, they think about these great theses that they have, the big pieces they've written, but sometimes it's the telling little details. And you've been in a lot of those rooms where it happens across the pond. What stays in your mind?
Well, Anne, in this grand setting that's filled with so much American history and so much British history here at the embassy, I do. It does send my mind back to certain moments when I, as a reporter, was really witnessing the special relationship in very human terms. The first, and I do think of this as kind of a high point for U.S.-UK relations, and what's more, for this kind of optimistic sense that the West is ascendant. Way back in May 1997, Bill Clinton had recently, just 6 months earlier, been reelected. Tony Blair, I think 3 weeks earlier, had been elected. Prime Minister Blair was 43. So for the first time that I'd ever seen it, Bill Clinton was the big brother in the relationship. He was used to being the kind of the precocious student. The heads of government, heads of state that he was interacting with were all a generation older than he was. Now here's somebody of his own generation, and actually a little bit younger. And Blair's admiration for him, really almost fawning, was obvious and maybe even a little bit over the top. But it was this moment where a certain set of ideas, centrist progressive ideas, were clearly in the ascendancy around the world. And there was so much optimism. The Cold War was over. There was a belief that Western trade policies would actually envelop China, and with open trade, China would join the world order. How naive was the optimism of that moment in retrospect? Of course, we were at that point 4.5 years away from 9/11 and the Iraq War. In the 2 decades, now almost a quarter century since then, the world order is marked by violence and disarray at almost every turn.
So let me put you on the spot. Do you believe that the transatlantic relationship is fundamentally strong and has blips, difficulties, challenges, whether it's Donald Trump, or often whether it's about other things, trade we haven't touched on as well? It's a huge and potentially growing source of discord across the Atlantic and between democracies, and also how they deal with the rise of China in that regard. Or do you think we're actually living through a period where we're in a bit of denial about how difficult the relationship can become?
Well, I don't think it's strong, Anne. I think it's marked by disillusion in many governments across the West. Certainly, it's marked by the breakdown in political civility and a spirit of problem solving here in the United States. So I say at the moment, maybe the most optimistic way of putting it is that the United States and other nations in the West were in a kind of a slackwater period, and at some point in due course we'll wake up and really reckon with the very serious challenges of the world. Obviously, there was a vigorous response at the beginning of the Ukraine war, but the Ukraine war is only one part of a broader reality that, to me, is very much as if we were in the late 1940s or early 1950s. We're in the midst of a long-term Cold War. To the east, in one direction, in Moscow, you've got a hostile government that's kind of backward-looking, trying to revive in a very nostalgic frame of mind the authoritarian governments and authoritarian practices of the Soviet Union and the other countries of the Warsaw Pact in Eastern Europe. You look the other direction, Beijing sees itself as the wave of the future, leading a very sort of futuristic government, but one based on surveillance and control, completely at odds with Western values. And what do we have in our in the middle? There's the West with politics that's surly, dysfunctional, marked by conspiracy theories, unable to solve problems. I think it's a rather stark moment. And I think that actually the ambassador, if you read between the lines, or maybe you'd have to read a fair amount into it, but I'm pretty sure she would agree with me on that.
You remind me when you were talking there particularly about Russia. I formerly was based in Russia, so it's a kind of moment for me when the ambassador suggested that I might like to reach out to the Kremlin and get Vladimir Putin on power play, which, by the way, I would be...
Let's get Booker's on the case, and...
I like
you,
that.
If you get him, I would be happy to join you for that interview, Anne.
Yes, whether it would be wise for us to go to Moscow is another question entirely, but yes, you can definitely join us if President Putin and his team are listening. But that was just a moment for me... I think for her as well, because she was in Ukraine, she was in the Balkans. When people say that to me, like previously, I would have said, yes, why not? Let's give that a try. I mean, I think we both know that that's less than likely to happen. And the way that now parts of the world feel closed off to me, someone who covered the fall of the wall, covered the coming out after communism. And I just a personal thought before we turn to your thoughts on this weekend here in Washington, do you just sometimes feel a little sad about what you've witnessed happening in international affairs for all the joy that it brings to journalists like us to cover it?
Very much so, and that's what I heard the ambassador saying. If I may paraphrase, it's, I've loved my time in Washington. I love America. I believe America is a special nation, and the relationship between America and the United Kingdom is a special one. And she wishes she could shake the United States by the lapels. Do you not realize the character of the opposition that we are up against around the world, fighting for essential values? I think that was her message.
Big weekend here in Washington, D.C., one of the most celebrated social and political weekends in the calendar. The main feature, of course, being the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Politico is there, along with all the other movers and shakers. Your memories, when did you first go to this? I'd like to think you still got the same dinner jacket coming out on Saturday.
It was a rental, I'm afraid, way back then. I've since bought one, but it was a good long time ago. And I've been a Washington reporter since I was a very much a young person. I think it was in the late 80s that I first went to the White House Correspondents' Dinner. But I should emphasize, at that time, it was not the swollen, extravagant event that it's become.
And yeah, and things stand out about that, because I wondered if it means anything. Some people listening to this might be saying, like, this is the ultimate bubble conversation. And these people, they get together for these events, and you have this big Saturday night, and of course you have that kind of humorous a speech that the president makes, often at the expense of journalists and media glitterati. Is it an orgy of self-love, or does it mean anything?
Well, I would agree with the first description. Somebody I used to work with at the Washington Post, Mark Leibovich, I think he's now at the Atlantic, he wrote a book called This Town. His thesis, I think, Anne, was that all of Washington political culture is an orgy of self-love. I think that goes too far. I think fundamentally in Washington, other capitals as well, is about fundamentally conscientious people trying to solve problems. But this weekend is a distillation of the vain, frivolous, and even self-absorbed side of Washington.
Well, let's see how the humorous act goes down this year. But there's always politics there, isn't there? President Obama famously chastising Donald Trump but using that platform. So the humor has a bite to it, don't you think?
Oh, sure, sometimes. The old saying is you're supposed to singe, not burn. But sometimes you actually do get a little bit of a burn in the humor. And, of course, you're mentioning that appearance in 2011. President Obama was making fun of Donald Trump, and some say that was the moment that Donald Trump resolved he was really going to run for president. you know, I don't know if that's apocryphal or not, because Donald Trump had been talking about a race for the presidency someday for many years before that. But he was definitely offended, and I think it did harden his resolve. That was the same night, by the way, that the White House and national security officials were all preparing for the raid in Afghanistan that ended up killing Osama bin Laden. So it was really remarkable, actually, that President Obama was there to be at that dinner, sort of cracking-wise. At the same time, the most sensitive national security operation of his presidency was underway.
Politics has a way, doesn't it, of cutting through the glitz. And that's when you hope Politico's around.
You know, it was. There are memorable nights in the years of going to that dinner. I remember late in Bill Clinton's presidency. Of course, he had been impeached as a result of the sex scandal, but Bill Clinton's a survivor. And he brought the house down in the spring of 2000 as his presidency was winding down. He really demonstrated that by no means was he a lame duck and by no means was he going to just shuffle off the stage.
John Harris, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Your memories of the White House Correspondents' Dinner passed, and you're going to be in your dinner jacket on Saturday night, right?
I will be in it, and what's changed over the years, I've got my own, no longer a rental.
You see, this is what happens. You become like founder of a major media company, and you can afford your own dinner jacket. Young listeners, this is the future for you.
And thanks so much. I hope you have a great time this weekend. Congratulations on a great interview with the ambassador. I thought it was terrific.
Thank you very much indeed, John. Well, that's all for this week's edition of Power Play. Next week, I'll be talking to the man hoping to be Donald Trump's national security advisor if he returns to office. We hope you enjoy our transatlantic conversation, whether you're with us here in the room at the British Embassy in Washington or keeping your own diplomatic relations with Politico and Power Play at home. Do keep listening. We would be so grateful if you could review us. And most importantly, please follow us on whichever platform you get your podcasts. The team behind this podcast is our regular duo, Peter Snowden and Christina Gonzalez. And a special thank you to our Washington colleagues, Callan Tansel-Suddeth and Annie Reese, for making this outside broadcast in DC into what we hope is a great listen.